Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Food Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and every major podcast provider. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player on our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or simply call into the show at area code 917-932-1068. If you would like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's topic, how to prepare your garden for a hurricane. After Katrina pummeled Louisiana, people are now taking every precaution when it comes to making sure that they are safe and also have enough food. But what about your landscape? There's a tremendous amount of rainwater runoff that can devastate lawns, plants, trees, and shrubs. Are there steps a homeowner can take to utilize this water or even divert it from covering your yard? What can you do when it comes to winds that are 100 miles, hundreds of miles an hour that can easily tear apart delicate foliage? Is there anything that can be done to protect valuable trees, shrubs, and other plants from the damage inflicted by debris? And one of the biggest questions that many people have is, can you salvage vegetables and fruit that are not quite ripe but are close to being ripe? And then the biggest question is, after the storm, how do you create a plan to restore all the damage and begin anew? Today, I'll be talking to horticultural expert John Peter Thompson, who's actually the president of the National Agricultural Research Alliance. And we're going to be talking about how you can prepare for severe inclement weather and what you do or which steps you should take after. So I would like to welcome back to the show John Peter Thompson. John Peter, good afternoon, and how are you?
Well, June, I actually should be outside doing what I'm about to tell you because right after this show, that's where I'm going. And you had a number of things there, and I hope I remember all of them. The bad news is a direct hit at sustained winds of 100 miles an hour, the plant is either going to survive or it isn't. There's no magic about water rising and flood. You're not diverting flood water. But let's assume you're not right down next to the creek and you're not in a floodplain. You're at a higher elevation and you're not worried about tidal swells and things. Certainly, there are things you could have done when you put the landscape in that might divert a little bit of water or drain water off your site, but you're not going to do them today. So that's the bad news. What are you going to do today? Well, the web is pretty full of this, but let me review. Anything that has feet, legs, or is not secure, you're going to bring inside. That means flower pots, hanging baskets. You haven't seen anything until you've seen a 10-inch hanging basket moving at 40 miles an hour towards your picture window. And you can expect 30 to 40 mile an hour sustained winds in a fuchsia basket or any kind of hanging basket, no matter where it is. And that kind of wind is simply going to go airborne. And, you know, the law of the Peter principle will apply. It will go through your most expensive window because that's where nature will send it. Lawn furniture, even the metal lawn furniture will go airborne.
Wow, that is a scary thought.
Trash cans, of course, if you want your trash can not in your living room without your permission, you need to secure it in a garage, in a basement. I know in an old house I had, I put the trash can sideways between the wall and my evergreen hedge, and they were pretty good there. So, I mean, there are some things to do if you don't have a basement, if you don't have a garage. You don't want to bring the trash can in. Well, don't leave it sitting out on the driveway. Also, bird baths.
Ah.
You want to see a flying saucer come through your wall, just try to imagine a 20-pound concrete bird bath top moving at 60 miles an hour.
Yeah, but John Peter, let me ask you a question. What if the bird bath, I mean, are you referring to concrete bird baths, or are you referring to
the
resin
ones? Well,
the
plastic ones,
or?
Are just going to go out of the neighborhood, so you don't have to worry about that. If you don't move your plastic bird bath, it won't be anywhere around for you to worry about. Yeah, no, I'm talking about the concrete ones, the ones you think won't move, especially if the top is not, you know, most bird baths that I'm familiar with, you can lift the top off. There's a pedestal and there's a bath, a top. At the very least, you want to take the top off and put it on the ground, and you want to lay the pedestal sideways on the ground. You don't have to bring it in, but you don't want to leave the flying saucer 3 feet off the ground in 40 to 60 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
The other thing, and I guess I should mention, don't leave tools outside. A rake turns into a projectile. So rakes, hose, shovels, they all have to be secured. Don't leave your lawnmower outside if you normally do it. I'm talking about a push mower because it can go airborne also. I've watched push mowers wind up across the field. This is not the gust of wind that might reach 60 miles an hour in a thunderstorm and is over by the time you figure out what's going on. These are sustained winds at 20, 30, 40 miles an hour with gusts up. And the sustained wind allows anything that's slightly mobile to go airborne, and I can assure you their target will be your house or the car. They rarely go between houses and cars. If nature has an option, it's going to fly it into your front windshield. So I think I've made that point. The other thing you should do, and it really is for the security of your house more than the plants, but if you're in a single-family dwelling or anything and when you're in charge of the roof, you need to go up and make sure that the summer leaves have not clogged up your, what do they call those things?
The drain
spouts and the guts. Get the leaves out now. Now, I happen to have wires over my gutters. I've already checked that. I think I'm okay. Also, make sure if you have the time, run a hose, have somebody hand a hose up there, run it down and make sure that water actually comes down the downspout and out. You don't want it backing up. Your garden doesn't particularly care, but the inside of your house, the walls, roofs, and in my case, my wife's closet will care if they back up. Now, while we're speaking of this, your garden will care if your downspouts come right off the house, right into the garden, and you don't have, I have concrete, I don't know what to call them, they're sort of vaguely funnel-shaped pieces of concrete on the ground. The water comes down the spout onto the concrete and runs off 2 feet. It kind of disperses the power of the water coming off the roof so it doesn't create a small sinkhole at the corner of my house. What can happen to some of the plantings around your house if you're not careful is it'll undermine that, and you could lose some of the evergreen or flowers or shrubs near the corner of your house. Many houses today actually have a I guess you'd call it a tube, irrigation kind of piping that comes off the bottom of the downspout and then it sort of disappears in the ground and it comes out someplace else. Make sure you know where the someplace else is. It will be on your property, not your neighbor's, and that water is actually coming out there. You don't want to create little mini sinkholes to undermine any plantings that you have near there. Also, while you're at it, in the summertime, we don't think about leaves falling, but leaves do. And if you have a basement stairwell that kind of goes down below the surface, get the leaves out of there. You will have leaves if you haven't been paying attention. Make sure that you don't clog up the drain to your basement entranceway, because you could flood your basement very quickly and very fast with the amount of rain that's coming down. So those are kind of things you can do and things that I will be doing. I will be removing. I have a potting table made out of plywood on sawhorses. As soon as this is over, I've got to dismantle my potting table, bring it into the barn, bring the sawhorses in. If you have signs out, I have a political sign in my front yard for a special election here in this county, and it's a 4x8 sign, and I'm afraid it'll pull my split rail fence down, so I probably have to take the sign down. If you have a for sale sign, a for rent sign on a rental property, bring it inside. It will not stay. it'll wind up in somebody's car or the side of somebody's house. Anything loose. Now, plants. So, as I said at the beginning, there's very little landscaping-wise you're going to do in the next 24 hours that is going to do anything. Certainly, if you have a low-hanging branch and you know in a thunderstorm it sort of crashes into the side of the house, you might want to do the pruning, cutting, shortening, if you can reach it safely now, because that's a branch, especially if it's overhanging your house, that's just asking to drop on your roof in the high winds. That is something you could particularly do. Let's talk about shade trees.
Well, before we get to that, I just want to point something out, because we've had some very interesting comments on Twitter. A lot of people don't understand why anyone would be doing anything with the landscape. They think that, oh, you should just be concerned about getting food and shelter, and that's it. So let's just talk about why we need to protect the landscape, not to mention the fact that there are many creatures that depend upon the trees as homes, not to mention, you know, the food sources, so on and so forth. So, John Peter, can you just elaborate in explicit detail?
Sure, $5,000 plus the damage to your house.
Well, not just that. I mean,
well,
obviously,
that
some
would
people...
be a good reason to be worried about it. If you have a 40 to 100-foot shade tree that could fall on your house, you will be paying attention as it crashes through the roof. And, yes, there's little you could do now, but in designing a landscape, this is the kind of thing you could think about. Standalone trees are susceptible to the force of this kind of wind. You're not going to do anything about that today, but when designing a landscape, you want to be thinking in terms of windbreaks. Farmers knew about windbreaks. They created hedgerows. They designed the landscape with many different plants, not just the tall shade tree standing by itself on a lawn, but understory plantings and hedge plants, and they created an interlocking ecosystem to break the wind so it didn't do damage to the house and protected the ornamental and vegetable garden, but it also supported itself. A hedgerow doesn't usually go down unless it's hit by a tidal influx of tidal water. There's very little. American tanks had a hard time going through hedgerows in World War II. They can stand 30, 40, 50-mile-an-hour winds sustained with no problem, and the secret was in designing a landscape with many, many species, not just one. For instance, a row of Leyland cypress, if you haven't been pruning them and they've kind of leaned in storms, they're likely to fall over now if you haven't used guy wire to try to hold them up. It's probably too late to bother with it. But if you put a hedge in, a diverse hedge of evergreens and deciduous, of flowering shrubs and hollies, then it is a windbreak. And it's likely to withstand this kind of damage. Now you're asking, who cares about taking care of the landscape for the rest of the ecosystem around us? And that sort of gets us off into the wonderful world of, why shouldn't we just throw our trash over the fence? Or why can't I pollute the water on my property and just send it downstream? If you think that's a good thing to do, then you probably are not going to be concerned about the landscape except as it crashes on your house. If, on the other hand, you think your quality of life is enhanced by supporting, caring for, and enhanced and taking care of all the species on your property, then, yeah, you are going to be more concerned. But what you can do right now, well, the animals, as we saw with the earthquake, are a lot more sensitive to changes in weather than we are, except for repeated blasts on public service announcements and governors declaring states of emergency. We as humans, urban humans, tend to be surprised. So here in Washington, a whole lot of people are going to be surprised in 24 hours because they're going to say, what's the big deal? The animals, meanwhile, will have figured it out and have moved to cover as fast as they can. And I'm not sure what you can do short of, for instance, the bird population after the storm passes, refilling. Oh, don't bring in your bird feeders. Don't leave them out. But right after the storm passes, put the bird feeders back out, fill them up. Hummingbirds, you know, will be looking for sources, and you can provide hummingbirds with the nectar, sugar, water that they need. Again, bring the feeders in during the storm, put them back out. Mammals and things, I don't know that I'm qualified to really go there, but I suspect that my skunk that lets me know she or he is here every night is going to be perfectly fine, and I think the black snake will hang out right at the basement door where she always does, and she'll be fine. My fox, if he doesn't fall into the swimming pool, will be down in the ravine and fine, and my groundhogs, which have mowed down my vegetable garden, will be perfectly fine under my barn. They simply aren't going to have a problem. The only thing that's going to have a problem may be the neighbor's cats. If she lets them out and they decide not to come back in, you know, domesticated pets will have a problem. Wildlife will find secure places much earlier than we humans do. Now, remember I said when you're designing a garden, if you design it with diversity in mind and not just one species lined up in a straight line, you will have better luck in maintaining the integrity of the garden in extreme events like this, these once every 30, 40-year events. If your garden reflects the East Coast ecosystem, at least in intent, by using many kinds, different species of plants and trees, then you are likely to have better success than the person that has turf grass and one maple. That person is asking for trouble. I mean, it's almost inevitable that a lone maple in the lawn or a lone blue spruce, blue spruces are pretty tough, but a lone anything in the middle of a turf grass desert is more likely, one, not to be providing food to wildlife anyway, and in this case, you wind up with a very expensive removal process because when it falls out of its hole, you're not putting it back in.
Now, John, what about, I know that your forte is not animals, but the thing is that the landscape does affect animals. Is there anything that you could do for any animals that are outside or may have a habitat outside in your yard? Like, for example, I know you have a fairly decent parcel of land. You've got a couple of acres, but what about somebody who has, for example, an acre or even less, but you may have bunny rabbits or some other critters that have found a home in your yard?
If they found a home, they're most likely going to take to the home. So first of all, I have a personal rule. I don't know that I can justify this. I don't feed the wildlife. I don't, I provide a 7-acre refuge, but the wildlife is wild because I don't try to domesticate it. It does have to take care of itself other than me providing 7 acres of mixed vegetation so that I do have my rabbits and the snakes and I can watch, you know, slow rabbits not make it home. And fast snakes get bigger. I try to keep the groundhogs out from underneath the barn, but I've lost this battle no matter what I do, and I won't use chemicals. So I'm, you know, I try to fill the holes, and they just dig new ones, and it's an ongoing battle. I have a ravine near my house. Well, actually, on my property, it's a 30-foot ravine, and I know much of the wildlife, including the deer, will be on. They won't be down in the ravine because it'll be a rushing gusher of water, but they'll be along the sides of it and perfectly safe within the ravine, protected from the winds. And because the ravine is populated by 30-year-old trees, some may come down, some may not, but the animals will fare better than I fear I will. For instance, I think my local power company can't keep the power on when the fog comes in, so I'm sure here in Washington, D.C., to be without power for a few days. I'm going to have a bigger problem than my wildlife because I have allowed most of the plants in my landscape are native to this area. Not all of them. You know, I'm a hosta grower. But the majority are native plants. And the native plants and the native animals and the native insects form a food web, a life web, if you will, and they'll take care of themselves. But you can't do that today. I mean, it's taken me 7 years to clear out the invasives, allow the natives, and I'm still working on it. I just feel good about the trees and things. If I may have a few fall down in the ravine, but I'm going to be in a good shape because I've anticipated this to some extent. He said bravely, let me know. I'll let you know next week when the power comes back on. This doesn't mean that you can't feed the birds and the hummingbirds after the storm. They are going to be looking for food sources, and the wind is going to strip a lot of leaves and flowers off things. So if you have a bed of petunias, the petunias are going to do just fine, or annuals of any kind, but mostly the flowers will be stripped off of them, leaving just vegetation. And
yeah, but John, that's going to be a very big problem, especially if they are host flowers for, say, butterflies, or if they are blooming and these flowers are food for bees. I mean, what then? I mean, go ahead.
That's why you have prepared 7 years ago a native, biologically diverse garden where you're not limited to one species that your butterflies and bees are dependent on. I have hundreds of species of things, and some of them, while some will lose their flowers, others have buds that will survive the wind and will open on Sunday morning when the sun comes out.
But the problem is that, you know, not everybody has that type of
foliage. Yeah, and there's very little you can do today.
Exactly. And now, one of the other things that I guess I personally am concerned about is lawn. Right now, I'm a little overdue with cutting the lawn. After the show, I will be out there doing everything that I possibly can muster. With lawn, especially with the flooding, I mean, it's really going to tear up the lawn. Is there anything that you can do?
No, you can't stop the water. If you were really interested in having a sort of a world-class turf with a like a fescue mix or a bluegrass mix or just pure fescue or bluegrass lawn, you would, and you knew you were in a low section before you put the lawn in, you would have put French tile or French drains in to handle to run water off from underneath the grass. If your lawn is on an elevation, you know, the lawn is beveled, so the center of the lawn is higher than the edges, and you took the time to make sure that the soil is well drained before you put the lawn in, then you'll be all right. I mean, that's how golf courses work. They'll be all right because they've done the homework and the planning. If, on the other hand, in a thunderstorm, your lawn stays soggy and kind of spongy for 24 hours, yeah, you're probably going to have a problem. The good news is most people who have a waterlogged problem probably don't have a world-class turf golf lawn to start with, and normally in August you have a weed patch. So look at this as an opportunity in September to go out and aerate the grass and sow new seed and sort of start over. Because September is lawn sowing time, and what I tell people on the East Coast here, normally in August you're getting rid of the weeds and preparing the ground for reseeding in the middle of September anyway. So just think of this as nature helping you out.
Another question that I have is in regards to, like, for example, there are certain I'm just trying to get this out because I'm thinking about it and I'm a little stressed because I have a gigantic pear tree filled with fruit and the pears are not quite ripe. And I know that these storms, when they hit, there goes the pears for the year.
Yes.
And I'm really concerned about this because I look forward to it. I make a lot of different things with the pears and What do you do? I mean, I just picked figs this morning. There were a lot of them that were not ripe. I picked a bunch that were ripe. I still have a bunch of figs that are still rock-hard little nubs. I have a lot of herbs that I need to pick. I mean, honestly, there's not enough time to pick everything, but what do you pick? What do you leave? What do you take a chance on?
Well, first of all, welcome to the farmer's world. You know, you hear about farmers make hay when the sun shines. This is because in harvest season, the farmers, the curse of the farmer is the weather that can ruin the entire harvest, and that's what you're talking about. Now, I'm not, I'm sort of winging it specifically. I would, the figs you can leave. The little hard nubs, they're going to be all right. You can leave the figs alone. Pears, on the other hand, probably have to pick what you can. I don't know that a really green pear at this time is going to ripen up. That's something you may have better, or one of your listeners may have a better idea of. You know, green apples, there are recipes for green apples. Peaches, you should be finished with peaches by now, so that shouldn't be a problem. When you get into the vegetables, of course, the tomatoes, if your tomatoes are staked and they're big, you know, and when I used to grow tomatoes before the deer took them out, we could get tomatoes 6-7 foot tall. I used 2x2s and 2x4s to stake them. Well, a hurricane coming through in the 90s took out my what looked like I was building a barn. It just leveled the 2x4s, and my tomatoes were on the ground. Most people, you know, farmers, they grow the tomatoes on the ground anyway. They're not out there staking hundreds of acres of tomatoes. I don't know what to suggest you do. I would pick as many of the tomatoes, even the green ones, you know, green fried tomatoes. Pumpkins, on the other hand, pumpkins should be just fine. It isn't going anywhere. I wouldn't bother. Interestingly enough, the pumpkins are pretty heavy. They're used to this. They'll sit right on the ground. I've seen a lot of things fly by me at the nursery when I lived at our production farm, but we had 30 acres of pumpkins, and I never saw a pumpkin in the field take to the sky, so I'd leave the pumpkins alone. The beans, if you've got, you know, a late crop of beans, I'd certainly pick that, and I'd pick corn. I mean, the corn can... If you only have two rows of corn, we're back to this interlocking support idea. Two rows of corn can't support itself. If you have a half an acre of corn, go pick the fresh corn and don't worry about it. The corn ears aren't going anywhere. Mm. And if you have enough corn in depth, it's a grass. It'll just bend in the grass. That's what it's supposed to do. What else? Cucumbers. You know, they're on the ground, and I don't remember my cucumbers taking to the air. I picked the fresh ones just to be safe. You don't know how long, if you have a garden where there might be standing water, squash and cucumbers underwater isn't a good idea for the vegetables. So I'd pick what I can, but I wouldn't pick the little guys. I'd leave those. They're not going into the air, and they're not going to become disconnected. It's things that trail and go up. If your cucumbers go up, if you have... the cucumbers going up a trailing arbor of some kind, then I pick them. But if they're on the ground, they'll be perfectly happy. Bush beans, you need to pick those. Fruits from trees as much as you can.
Yeah, now what about with herbs? I mean, how badly damaged would you say that certain herbs are? You know, what do you think these storms are going to do to the herbs?
Almost nothing. Because they're fairly... Like, I have rosemary that's 3 feet tall.
Rosemary's pretty hardy, but what about something like basil, for example, or...
It's got a thin stem, and it will simply blow... It'll flow with the wind, unlike the oak, and then it'll spring back up. This year I didn't grow any, but if I did, you know, my wife would probably be out picking some basil right now.
Making pesto, yeah.
And then she freezes it just in case. But your herbs are going to be fine. Now, if you tend to be underwater,
yeah,
that's a different problem. Most herbs do not like wet roots.
No, and they tend to rot pretty quickly.
Right, and you do not have any time to do anything about that.
No, I mean, this storm, even though we've heard about it for the last couple of days, honestly, people really haven't prepared for it. And the thing is that there's so much to do. I mean, I've been getting calls left and right from people, especially friends from New Orleans that are particularly concerned because, you know, they've been through the ringer. My friend Sal Fakara called me and he said, well, you know, fill the bathtub up with water. Make sure you take some of the garbage cans outside, fill them up with water, because be prepared, you're going to be without electricity for several days. And he said, get some dry ice and, you know, just bring anything that can fly from outside in.
Yeah, thank you very much. I forgot about the you won't need water for the plants, but you will need water for yourself. I mean, I've got bottled water here, but I'll fill up some buckets of water, too. I guess I can fill the bathtub up.
Well,
good idea. See something else for my list. I'll fill the bathtub up.
Well, one of the concerns that I had, this is kind of interesting, but last night I figured, let me stop off. I'll just pick up a little bit of extra water, and it was just very interesting that everything was sold out except for a lot of organic food and, of course, all the vegan food. But all the junk food, all the other garbage, everything was just gone.
Well, so that means that the vegans and vegetarians were well-stocked anyway.
We'll survive.
Yeah, and they'll survive.
But the thing is that, seriously, though, it's just amazing when you think about it. I mean, people neglect to remember that they have pets, and anything with your pets should also be secured. Right now, I'm not really too sure. I have a butterfly habitat. I don't really know what I should do. I mean, the statues I'll bring in, of course.
Or lie them down.
Or lie them down, yeah.
Just reduce the area that the wind can get to. I mean, if they're like granite, marble, or concrete, lie them down. If they're plastic, bring them in.
Yeah.
But otherwise, lie them down. Just reduce the sail. Think of anything standing up as like a sailboat, giant sail.
Now, another question is steaks. I have steaks in my tomatoes. I have steaks for my cucumbers. And they're bamboo steaks, so what do I do? Do I remove them? Do I leave them? Do I try to reinforce them?
Well, no, I you just leave them. If the wind is strong enough and the plant's healthy enough, they'll just break the steaks off and go to the ground and be happy. I don't, fooling around with those now I don't see the return on doing that. And the steaks, there's going to be lots of twigs. The bamboo steaks are effectively just more debris or twigs floating around. Don't worry about them.
Well, one thing that I am particularly worried about is I also have certain trees that survived a storm from last year in which these gigantic oak trees and all sorts of different trees were just uprooted, almost like a giant just came along and plucked them out of the ground. What I'm concerned is that I have one particular tree that it seems to be very strong, but the branches that were on the lower part of the tree, they came off from that particular storm, and I'm just concerned that, okay, here we go again.
What kind of tree?
Do you think that these trees that have successfully made it through the last storm, you know, with a hurricane, this is a whole different ball game. I mean, the storm that we had, I forgot the name of what they referred to the particular storm as, but as I said, it was almost as if the wind just uprooted these trees like a giant, and I just cringe at the thought of that happening again.
All right. Well, so you raise an interesting question. I don't know about New York. I suspect you've had similar amount of rainfall this year that we've had down here. And one of the problems that we're going to have in Washington is the drought of 10 years is no longer, and we've had a substantial amount of rain this year, and so the ground is already saturated. And many of our ornamental trees and our favorite trees and pine trees and evergreens tend to be this, are shallow rooted. Now, when they're planted close together, like redwoods in California, they hold each other up. But when you have one of them around and then the ground is very wet, that's when they tend to be uprooted in wind. There's no way of supporting them. If the ground were dry like concrete, you'd have other issues because the tree, if it was 10 years of drought, then the tree may still fall over because it's dying. But when the ground is very wet, street trees, trees on slopes, trees wherever water might stand, and just about any tree, I mean, will come tumbling down when you add wind because the ground is turned to pudding. There isn't anything you can do about that. You have to assess the type of tree, your local extension. If you can figure out what kind of tree, your local extension can tell you about the root system. And then, as I said at the beginning of the show, if it's close to a house, close to a garden, close to a structure, and it has branches that have broken off in the past, and you have low-hanging branches, that you can reach easily. That doesn't mean climbing on a ladder in a hurry right now with a chainsaw. Do not do that. You could trim those problematic branches and try to reduce the possibility of the wind catching a weak, low-hanging branch. But if it's a major ornamental specimen or a major tree, you really ought to have I feel a little bit like a doctor trying to tell you how to set a broken arm without seeing the broken arm or the patient.
Oh, of course, of course.
Well, you really need a master gardener at least, or somebody from extension, or at the very least, a independent nursery to stop by and assess what you've got and what you could do. When I used to run a 150-year-old cemetery, and we had beautiful plane trees lining the cemetery, and they were 100 years old. Some people remember being little children when they were planted, and we wanted to protect the trees, so we knew that it was up on a hill, storms come to Maryland. We spent a lot of money and had professionals come in and reinforce the tree with guy wires, which most people could see, so nobody tripped over them except for me. I was always discovering where the guy wire was.
Well, the thing is that there are a lot of people that don't have that luxury, and plus, due to all sorts of cuts, getting an extension, master gardener to come out is not always possible. But the thing is that I guess the concern is with the trees, the shrubs, and everything else, the amount of damage that could be caused, not just to your property, but to your neighbors, is a very big concern.
Sure.
$1,000
to $5,000 to remove that 60 to 100.
Well, yeah, tree. You're talking about the tree removal, and after the storms, the gouging begins.
Sure.
And the thing is that you have these companies that charge an arm and a leg. I mean, it's ridiculous. And
absolutely,
they get away with it. Of course they get away with it. I mean, just as I'm assuming that the gas prices are going to go skyrocketing. But the thing is that at this particular point, it's not something that everybody can really afford to have a professional come in. Now, one comment that was just made on Facebook is, what about your neighbor? What if your neighbor is out of town? What do you do?
Huh. Well, in the case of my neighbor, when he's out of town, I know about it, and I sort of have carte blanche to, of course, he has 10 acres. It's not like anything of his is going to fall over on me, but we're pretty neighborly. And we look after each other's landscapes when we're not in town. So when the snows trapped me in, he plowed me out with his little snowblower. When trees fell, I come with my chainsaw. And if he's not there, I would clear his driveway. But I know I have his permission. I just mowed down his ragweed that he thought he was, I don't know what he thought he was doing, But I knew I could do that. If you don't have the relationship with your neighbor, you can't go traipsing over onto your neighbor's property and make even cosmetic changes to the landscape. That's not... You and the neighbor need to have worked this out before.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you don't have it worked out, I remember I had an elderly neighbor that was visiting grandchildren and whatnot, and, you know, whenever there was a snowstorm or something, I would always dig out their driveway and just do the neighborly thing. But, I mean, you know, not everybody has... And it's not like, you know, we had the greatest relationship. It was just a common courtesy that I would just do because I know that they weren't there. And I would just hope somebody would do the same thing for me. But if, like, for example, a colleague of mine who's actually a beekeeper said to me, you know, I've got a neighbor who is out of town. We don't have the keys to his house, but, you know, what should we do? And I said, you know, just try to do the best that you can. But, I mean, that's all you really can do. You can't really go too crazy because especially if they don't have access to the house.
Well, that's right. I mean, maybe another one of your listeners happens to be a lawyer, and then they can really tell us what the liability and responsibility is. You know, if you live in suburbia and your neighbor has a 60-foot tree leaning over your house, I would have hoped that you would have had a discussion with the neighbor or the owner of the property a long time before this event. Because even though the neighbor may be responsible, the tree coming down on your roof, you don't really care who's responsible, and you can't go running over onto his property and cut it down.
No, you can't.
So this goes into landscaping is not something that you do 24 hours before an event. I mean, I know people who try to landscape before a wedding, and they have enough money, they almost pull it off. But even a ton of money isn't going to protect your landscape against a 200-mile-wide hurricane. So landscaping is about preparation and planning and about constant change. And the damage that we may see in places, I think of it as nature pruning the garden.
To a certain degree, but I just want to add one other comment before we talk about how nature is so nicely helping us out. There are a couple people that said that they actually don't mind helping out their neighbor because of the fact that if their neighbor's property, if the, you know, different chairs and whatnot, if they do break loose and, like, say, if you have an umbrella, which needs to be taken down without a doubt, but if the umbrella is left there and then the umbrella becomes some type of spear and goes right through the window, their window, not the neighbor's window, then, you know, they're basically looking out for themselves as well.
You know, we're wandering over into, this is the if you know your neighbor, and so I know my neighbors, and I feel comfortable about helping them out as I know they feel comfortable about helping out if I'm not here. But that's because we have, shall we say, a verbal understanding beforehand. If you don't know your neighbor, I don't want to be, that's trespassing. So we need a lawyer to weigh in here. I'm a, you know, natural philosopher, not a lawyer, but I can just, my neighbor is a lawyer, so I can imagine the business that comes out of that. On the other hand, if their umbrella or their tree, yeah, they're responsible, but meanwhile you have the hole in the wall while you busily try to collect. Know your neighbor and come to an understanding.
Well, that's why you pick up the phone. That's why you pick up the phone and you say, hey, listen, you know, I'm going to do this and this. I personally look at it this way. If one of my neighbors did a favor for me and secured something outside, I would appreciate it. And, you know, if things happen, I mean, they happen. It's your own fault. But if somebody's doing you a favor, you can't exactly be like, well, you know, I'm going to take you to court, blah, blah, blah. That's just,
we would like to think that as neighbors that we all know each other and that we all support each other, and in that altruistic environment, by all means. I just, you know, want people to remember English common law and trespass. Make sure you've talked to your neighbor, or that you at least know their name before you trundle over onto their property. And removing an umbrella, well, you probably won't be accused of theft. Starting to make landscape changes, that's, you better know who your neighbor is before you make landscape changes on their property.
Well, you're not talking about major landscape changes. I mean, you're not cutting down a tree. That would be extraneous.
Even a branch.
I'm just talking about bringing in some furniture, stuff like that. You know, if it is a branch that's a little troublesome, can't you tie it back? Isn't that an option?
As long as you don't create damage in doing it, that the neighbor can then come back at you and say, you were on my property and caused this damage, even though you prevented something from happening. That's why they have Good Samaritan laws when it comes to helping people. You help a person, then you find yourself being sued. I think we're kind of getting into an area where I have no business talking. Let's see if one of our listeners is actually a lawyer, and then we can get into the wild and woolly property rights.
Well, there are many lawyers that do tune into the show, but that's a whole other subject for a whole other time. In the interim, let's talk about after the storm has passed. Okay, you find that in your yard, hypothetically speaking, of course, you have a gigantic branch or tree that has been... that has now become the center of your yard. You can't find a tree service. What do you do?
Well, you get out your trusty chainsaw that you are fully equipped to handle, including your, Kevlar?
What if you can't exactly get to it? How long do you really have before you really need to remove that tree?
Oh, you have until the local zoning authority or health department or whoever monitors your neighborhood comes along and cites you for having a hideous-looking something in your yard. The fallen tree will kill the grass under it and anything under it, but in fact it's going to provide a haven for wildlife. I mean, trees fall in the woods all the time.
Mm.
You could build a garden around a fallen tree. A beautiful garden. Your neighbors may think you have lost your marbles, but nature, this is a natural thing. So the only people that are going to be concerned are the people next door and across the street who think this is sight unsightly and find some local authority to cite you for not cleaning up your yard. But the birds and the bees and the bugs, they're going to love you. You'll get fungi, you'll get all kinds of cool mushrooms eventually, you'll get wildflowers underneath. It'll be great.
Yeah, and you'll also have another great relationship with your neighbors for having...
Yeah, I mean, so what you're asking me is, if you can't get to it right away, don't worry about it. Get to it when you can, hopefully before your neighbors think you've stopped participating in the civic responsibilities. Now, the longer it sits, you know, 7 to 10 days, if it fell on your lawn, oh, I'm very sorry.
And so it fell on your lawn. What do you do?
The grass will die.
But the thing is that with grass is pretty resilient.
Yeah, that's right. And it will come back if you get the tree up in 2 weeks or so. It'll come back. Or, because this is August, just reseed it. That's all you have to do is reseed once you have the tree up. And you have until October to reseed. And if you don't get the seed down in October, you can do a temporary patch next spring.
That's a good point. Now, there's another question that we have, and it's diversion of the runoff water. Is there anything that you really can do, especially if you know that you're going to be pummeled with rainwater?
So we used to have fields and everything, and I would create gardens that were beveled. In other words, they had a high point and they sloped down, and then where the water sloped, I created runoff channels, which were had rocks in them, and I, of course, landscaped them to collect the water from the top of my gardens and move it to the side of the property and then down to either natural ravines, natural areas, or best of all, in normal rain events, to rain gardens. Now, this isn't a normal event, and rain gardens are going to be swamped. They'll be happy. There's nothing going to happen to them, but they're not going to contain this amount of water. So you can plan your garden to maneuver water by building garden channels and rain gardens, and you can keep normal year-to-year rain. You can keep all the water on your property with no problem at all, with a lot of planning and very little. I mean, other than labor, there's no material cost in making rain gardens and channeling water to low spots and making these plantings that will absorb the water. This is not a normal amount of water. You're going to get two inches or more an hour, maybe 3 or 4 inches an hour for 8 hours or whatever it is. The rain gardens and channels will be swamped, but they will not be damaged.
Mm.
It's going to have a lot of water moving all over the place, and you're not controlling the water from a hurricane. This is, while it is normal, it's not a normal yearly event. We don't get a hurricane in the Mid-Atlantic in New England every year like clockwork. Rain is basically going to wash all the trash and debris off your yard.
We have a question actually from the audience. Jessica would like to know if the rainwater is safe to use for gardening.
Oh, sure, sure.
Even with the acid rain factor?
Well, so here's the thing. All sort of explosion, atmospheric events, including volcanic eruptions, are acidic in nature, and you as a human and mammals being mammals, and you're one of them, you are genetically or physiologically predisposed to deal with a certain tolerance of acidity. That's what mucus does. Now, is it good for you? No. But you as a mammal are able to deal with it. Your problem is the other side of the pH scale. So, for instance, when the towers fell in New York, the resulting pollution in the air was not acidic. It was Drano. It was pH of 11 to 13. That's why people got so sick. The human body can't handle pH of 11 to 13. It can deal with 3 to 4 for a short amount of time. So let's talk about using the rainwater for your plants. Now, I'm not saying drink it. If I were going to drink rainwater, I'd distill it first. Everybody knows what that is, right? Boil it off, collect the steam, let it trickle back down. Distilled rainwater is fine. You get rid of everything in it, and you're just drinking pure water. I would, however, use rainwater and have rain barrels. So that's another thing for me to check. I think I have a working rain barrel.
But with the rain barrels...
And I use those to water the plants.
Well, that's what I do with my rain barrels, but what I have is I actually take screening, old screening, and, you know, it takes a little bit of time, but what I did was I actually made almost like a filter so that there would not be any... openings for mosquitoes to go in and
sure.
create their own little habitat. And then, you know, before I know it, I have my own West Nile virus laboratory brewing out of, you know, one of these rain barrels that I've created. So, and what I found is that especially when there's tremendous rain, I can collect a lot of water, and I do use this in for my plants. So that's something that is... It's not such a bad idea to think about.
Let's address your acidity question, though.
Sure.
So for most East Coast ecosystems, they are built on an assumption of acidic soils. Let me say that again. Most native plants like acidic soils. What we do when we farm, because we are bringing mostly non-native plants in, is we add lime and we sweeten the soil, when we put lawns in, we sweeten the soil because the lawn itself is Eurasian and most of our vegetables are Eurasian, and they want an alkaline or sweet soil, so we spread lime all over the place. If the pH gets in your soil because of the rainwater, because of acidic rain, lowers your pH down into the 4.5, you know, below 5 range over time, then add a little bit of lime and bring it back up to 5, 6. You know, 6 is probably a good place for vegetables, 6.5, 7. 7 is lawn, and there's not too much that you're going to grow to eat that wants to be above 7.
Mm.
So check your soil acidity once every, well, you should do it every year, but once every 3 years. Rainwater is fine, but check the soil.
Mm.
So the acidity in the water isn't going to hurt the plants directly. What it'll do is change the acidity in the soil. And if it gets too acidic, then the plants can't take up what you call plant food and what I call the nutrients necessary for life.
Thank you. Now, we're almost out of time, John Peter. Are there any last-minute reminders that you just want to leave our audience with?
Yeah, if it's flying past you, duck. Something else is coming behind it. Learn that lesson, too.
Besides that.
Pumpkin, there's a second one coming a few minutes later. Duck. No, use common sense. That's what you need to do. Use common sense.
Yeah, the one thing that just amazes me is either people will be prepared or people will wait to the very last minute to do anything. Now, one last question that I have, and this is a very big concern with many of our listeners because I've received so many comments about it, is where do you park your car?
Yeah.
Especially if you live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of trees and you don't have the luxury of parking it in a space or, in a place that is secure, like inside a garage or something, what do you do?
Well, if you can't get to a public parking garage.
And not many, I mean.
Interior wall, you know, above the first level, so in case it floods, is about as secure as you're going to get. And in the past, when I lived in a more urban part of Washington, D.C., I would park my car at a public parking garage overnight and then go back and retrieve it. Right now, I park my car out in a field where there's no tree that can fall on it. That's what I do. And I happen to have the luxury of having, you know, fields in their steps, and I park it in the highest field, and it'll be perfectly fine because nothing can fall on it. If you are parking your car under a solitary maple or sycamore standing in the middle of nothing else, that's probably not a clever idea because you don't know which direction the maple or sycamore or whatever it is going to fall. If, on the other hand, you have a hedgerow, a real hedgerow of many, many native plants working together, park your car on the, you know, against the wind, the non-wind side. I know there's a technical windward, leeward side, I guess, of the hedgerow. That's what I do. But if it's a Leyland hedge, Leyland cypress, do not park your car near that. That's not going to be helpful. Especially if you have 20, 30, 40-foot Lelands, you're about to find out why they're not a really great tree.
Now, one last comment that I want to make really quickly is that, you know, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Just recently, a few weeks ago, in a few towns away, on Garden City, they got pummeled with hail that was the size of a golf ball, and many people lost their windshields. I happened to have parked underneath a very shady tree, the pine tree, but I didn't sustain any damage. So it's kind of, it's almost as if, you know, it's going to be a matter of luck. So, you know.
I think you have the final word there.
Exactly. But, John Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Hopefully the information that we've given the audience will help people prepare for Hurricane Irene and other inclement weather that is to come, because this we still have quite a way to go when it comes to hurricane weather.
Okay, well, I'm going to go out and prepare my yard now.
That is exactly what I'm going to be doing as well. Folks, please take care, and please do as John Peter Thompson instructed, and thank you for tuning in. Have a great weekend.
Bye.